Welcome back to the Buck Starts Here, Buck Wild edition, where the history is loud, the decisions are bad, and the 1840s are basically a fever dream with uniforms. Today we're diving headfirst into the diplomatic dumpster fire that culminates with the Mexican-American War. Eric likes to do things right, which means we went twice as long as expected, so this is part one of our two-part breakdown, in which we cover all the petty buildup, the bad communications, the weird border mass, and the what-did-you-think-would-happen moments that drag two nations into a fight that neither of them are ready for. So grab some water, grab a map, and please, for the love of Adams, don't take legs as war trophies. Let's get buck wild. Bienvenido to the Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild gyros that shape the presidencies of the United States. Today, we finally get to shine a light on one of the less discussed wars of our past. Mi amo Kyle, the Slowpoke Rodriguez, to Eric Speedy Gonzalez. And if I haven't foreshadowed it enough, we are taking sides in the Mexican-American War.
Are we actually taking sides? Are you arguing pro? What side are we on?
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Okay, well, we'll do it. We'll run through it, and at the end, you can decide which side you would have been on.
I'm guessing I had the right side, but, you know, we'll see.
We'll see.
We've argued about the Alamo a few times about who's the good guys on that one.
We're talking about the Mexican-American War, not the Texas War of Independence. So all the crap talking I do about that is not, it's kind of not going to apply here.
Oh, so it has nothing to do with Tejas in general? Just
oh, it does. Yeah, no. Oh, okay. Right. Very much okay. Does. No, right. But from the U.S. perspective.
If slavery has anything to do with this fight.
Kind of, but not. See, the only reason I would say it not definitively is because of California's involvement, which was a free state.
But, I mean, we also learned that was because of Mr. Taylor's insistence to Congress and refusal to compromise.
And his very much, I mean, yes, totally they didn't want to deal with Taylor on this. But also the fact that, like, yeah, the Texas side does make it hard because that was very much about slavery. That was very much about slavery. But let's set the stage. So let's go back to, we're going to talk about the 1820s and 30s, which are going to really put us in the direction. No, yeah, no, the 1820s very, very
influential. Spent a lot of time there.
Yeah. So in 1821, Mexico becomes independent of Spain. So they're their own country, and it inherits a very hard-to-manage area where you have this massive northern frontier that is almost inhospitable, but that then goes into modern Texas, right? Modern Texas. And what is modern Texas divided of? You have, you know, West Texas, which is this beautifully stunning, but relatively sparse landscape. Up into Northeast, modern day Northeast Texas, which in East Texas, which is almost, I mean, Eastern Texas is almost like swampland in many cases, more resembles Louisiana than it does New Mexico. So Spain is kind of in this weird position where they inherit all this territory and they have that, you know, their justifications up to California.
Spain or Mexico?
Well, this is Mexico because they just
Mexico inherits it from Spain.
Spain's like effectively not here anymore. So they have all this land. Now, at the time, gold hadn't been discovered. Had not been discovered yet. That was until 1848 in California. So California is, again, frontiers land, not necessarily what we consider this, you know, speculatory area. Certain part of the idea of manifest destiny, but again, we're in the 1820s. We're in early 1820s. So the American frontier is Kentucky and Tennessee. It's not California. So what's the first thing Mexico does? Well, the Mexican government actually invites Anglo-American settlers into the Texas, effectively the Texas ranch area, in the 1820s. And this is part of the Empresario system. And what this is basically settlers who are there to develop the land, hopefully generate tax revenue, and reinforce the Mexico's claim to that territory. Instead of just sparse land that's ill-defined, they were like, oh, if we have settlers come in and effectively move to Mexico and farm and ranch, we're going to build up our sustained right to this land.
So is that sort of like what the U.S. was doing with like the westward expansion when they're giving away all the land in Oregon and Kentucky and all the other places?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This idea that if you settle the land and you manage the land, it's your land. So Stephen F. Austin, you know, he's kind of the big guy at this point, obviously, where the capital of Texas's name comes from. He's just going around hitting people's stunners. It was really just, it was a great time. Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Oh, God.
How do you miss that? That's like perfectly your age group too.
I couldn't get that out of my head. I was trying to figure out how you're going to work Sam Houston into this, and I couldn't. I was trying to remember if he was a good person or not.
yeah, we're not going to cover them. We'll do that in a different episode. That'll be much more heated. So as Sam Austin kind of leads the settlement period, he does this weird thing, which is he brings a bunch of slaves with him. And Mexico had already been on the path of dissolving slavery. And they were taking a more... Mexico will define it as an abolitionist movement. I think we would... I don't think that's a wrong way for Mexico to describe the movement. But I think if we take it more... If we take it in a more broad sense, we would probably call it an emancipation movement.
Abolitionist Mexico, means like now. Now. We're doing it right now. Emancipation
now we'll fight about
date.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Usually emancipation movements are political and abolitionist movements are military.
Mm-hmm.
So we end up having, we end up with a lot of these tensions. There's a lot of cultural, legal differences, and of course political differences between what are native Mexicans to the area and these new settlers. The reasons span greatly. Obviously, politically, they're different. You know, people who grew up under Spanish rule versus, you know, the United States is almost 50 years old this time. Certainly a more Republican view of the world. Republican, I don't mean the political party. I mean literally the system.
1820s Republican.
Yeah, not even 18, not even like Republican party. I just mean like
no, that doesn't even exist yet at this point.
Yeah, no, we're still a little ways away.
Yeah.
This war would lead to the creation of the Republican party, interesting enough. It's cultural too. Mexicans were Catholic. A lot of them moving in were Protestants. By this point, the Catholic Church had outlawed slavery. The Catholic Church had denounced slavery for hundreds of years before.
Like most of the world, I think, had already.
1800s, kind of. I mean, there's more slaves in the world today than there was in 1850. So, I mean, kind of.
That's kind of a sad stat.
Yeah.
To know.
I've heard people say, well, not legal slavery. And I'm like, I don't think people who own slaves care about the law. I think if you're owning people, there's many parts of the law you've already violated to get to that point. So it's always been a weird argument to me. Like, oh no, there's no more legal slavery because East Timor was like the last place that I believe the last place outlawed slavery. And I'm like, but again, I just don't think those people look at the brick factories in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
That's just debt slavery. Oh, it's debt slavery. That's not real slavery. I'm like, tell that to the person who has generational debt. Like,
what was the one in Australia you like to point out too? That they just ship everybody off to? Oh, that's the one. Oh, that was
the one. Then there's Narok. I always pronounce it correctly. That's not really slavery. That's more just like penal compound for a penal compound, I guess.
Right.
Like Australia, what are you doing, dude? Huge empty
You should
continent.
Know better than that.
Yeah. I think Australia is like the size of Pluto. Like you basically is that? Hold on.
That
I've never seen a
awesome
map on that.
Statistic. I've never heard that comparison.
Yeah. Okay. So Australia is wider than Pluto. So Australia is 4,000 kilometers wide. Pluto's diameter is 2,300 kilometers. But Pluto is 1.5 times, sorry, 2.5 times more surface area than Australia. So, yeah. So you start to see a lot of tension building in the area between these two groups. Now, Mexico actually had a pragmatic solution there. And this is where I think gets lost a lot of times when this topic gets taught, which is this idea of like, oh, you know, President Santa Anna rose up and, you know, had this military coup. And then he came over there and, you know, attacked Texas. Yes, that's obviously a hyperbole, just like everything has nuance.
Right.
But for the first 10 years of this arrangement, it was actually quite logical. It was a federalist system. Mm-hmm. So the Texas was governing itself. And here's where it becomes interesting. And this is where the kind of the Texas idea of independence comes from, is in the 1824 Constitution of Mexico, they explicitly made it clear that they were going to be a federal, they're going to be federalized, mm-hmm. that it was going to be a federation, and Texas, just like states, were going to manage their own affairs. When Santa Anna rises up, again, I don't want to paint him as if he's like a dictator or stuff like that. I don't know if that's a fair. I'm sure there's like people who have different opinions on it, and obviously the show's not just about Santayana.
I mean, but, I think you can make certain assumptions if you're a military leader who sees control using the military. There's probably,
but you know, he won his election. Like, he,
right?
Yeah. And so when he comes in there, he decides, he's like, you know what? We need a centralized rule. We're no longer going to do this federalization. And he is very interesting by him. So he doesn't just alienate Texas. I want to make this clear. He looks to he looks to transition from federalism to centralism across the entire country.
Is Mexico federalist now? Because like they have states like Guadalajara or like other places like that, right?
They do. They still have states. I think most people would describe Mexico as centralized.
Like,
You know, Spain has, not Spain, sorry. France has subnational categorizations of governance, but I mean, France is still very centralized. But right now, I was about to say the Fifth Republic, but like by the time people hear this, like there could be a new French Republic given what's going on in France.
First
right
time
now.
You told me that, like the next week, I saw news that their government had failed. I'm like, oh no.
Yeah. So this leads up to the Texas Revolution in 1835. Basically, you know, long story short, what ends up happening is tensions boil over. You have the assault on the Alamo, and these things become emotional. Symbols. And what's I always find interesting is the Texas War of Independence actually ends with Santa Anna being captured. In fact, his leg was on display, I believe, in there was a museum in Illinois.
What?
They displayed, he lost his leg. Like he had a fake leg.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And
not the real one.
Yeah, we had his fake leg. The Texans had it. It was in a museum, I believe, in Illinois.
Definitely means they won.
Yeah, and we didn't return until like the 90s. There's actually a King of the Hill episode about it.
Oh, jeez.
And people thought it was fake. And it's like, no, that's a real thing. After Santa Anna's captured, Texas really is formed into the modern Texas Republic. And I know I said we weren't going to talk about the Texas War of Independence and all that stuff, but this is what spurs the Mexican-American War.
Yeah.
Because Mexico refuses to recognize Texas independent. And they just view it as a rebellious province. And what's interesting is that it actually takes a year for the U.S. to even recognize Texas independence. And this is seen as a political move.
Was that because of the, like Polk's, like, remember that Polk, I think he left Texas to be dealt with by the next president. Like, there was some delay in there, right?
Yeah, this is 1836, 1837, so this is Martin Van Buren.
So
this is not annexation of Texas. This is recognizing it as its own country.
Just recognizing that it...
And this is one of the frustrating parts about the Mexican-American War and this period in U.S. history when it's taught is that it's viewed very flat, as if there's not like 15 years between these two things. 1836 rolls around, 1837, U.S. recognizes them, but from 1836 to 1844, there's this diplomatic stalemate over Texas between the United States and Mexico. So Mexico maintained this policy of non-recognition and actually continued to launch raids into Texas to try and reclaim it. By this point, Texas is built up. It's already economically pretty powerful. In Mexico, as we'll learn as we talk about the Mexican-American War, is not as technologically advanced in terms of weaponry. Excellent soldiers, good military doctrine, you know, very competent, but you're talking, you know, about an already growing chasm of military technology that would really rear its head, you know, about 10 more years. And think of fast technology progressed from the mid 1830s to the late 1840s. I mean, you were talking, Kyle, you brought it up last episode. Right. You're talking about revolvers. Revolvers become a thing. That's wild. For the first time in history, you can fire a gun without having to reload it.
Right.
Yeah, like that's whoever has that is going to win that engagement. Basically, Mexico is fighting itself. There's a conservative and a liberal faction in Mexico that are basically ripping each other apart, blaming them for the Texas War. And they can never get enough. They can't devote enough resources. It's super far away. The supply chains are horrific.
Yeah.
But Texas then turns to the United States and basically asks to be annexed. And Martin, and just like you said, Van Buren and Tyler approach, you know, this question cautiously, but they're not, do they think this is going to start a war with Mexico? Kind of. They more care about the sectional divides and is this going to expand slavery?
Right.
But this continues to progress all the way up through Polk. As a major domestic, and it's interesting, this is considered a domestic political issue. You know, we're talking about annexing
Texas another country.
Another country.
Yeah.
So by 1844, John Taylor has successfully negotiates an annexation treaty with Texas. That as we know, then promptly fails when getting ratified by the Senate. It pretty much fails because of sectionalism, because of this idea of the expansion of slavery. By 1844, we're really starting to see the aftermath of the 1844 election, where Polk rises to power. This idea, he supports the annexation. He's a big Manifest Destiny. You know, he takes his win as a political referendum, a populist political referendum, that he must annex Texas. Mm-hmm. And he signals, interesting enough, Polk, again, like we talked about, 54-40 or fight, followed by diplomacy.
Right, right.
Polk actually tries to kind of feel out Mexico on this. He's kind of like, you guys can't take it back. You've been trying to take it back at this point for a decade. It's not working. You were pretty handedly defeated. Come on. What are we doing here?
Do you think that if they would have just left it alone and said, you know what, you deal with Texas, that maybe they could have held on to some of the other parts that they ended up losing?
Yes, 100%. Yeah. And the reason we know this, and Kyle, great question. The reason we know this is because the United States claimed that Texas's southern boundary was the Rio Grande. They were like, yeah. Hey, Rio Grande, however you pronounce it. They're like, that's the boundary. And I don't want to sound like a revisionist. It kind of makes sense because it's like, as we know, if you go to that area of Texas, it's like empty, 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 empty. And then literally you get to the Rio, obviously it's a watershed. And it's like, okay, now you start seeing it's still desert and such, but it starts to become more what we consider
rivers, water begets life. That's where
settlements happen. Yeah, right. You start to see that's the line where new development is. So it's okay, the border is where the next group of people are. Not the best argument, because you have the Nuez River, which is where Mexico thinks the border is, because that's pretty much the river closest to the farmland. I wouldn't say farmland, ranch land in Texas.
I'm guessing that one doesn't dip so far south.
No, it does not.
Okay.
Right. So you can obviously see that Mexico doesn't want the Rio. You can see why the U.S. doesn't want the Nuez. So Mexico actually enforces where they think the boundary is and have been effectively administrating that no man's land between the Nuez and the Rio Grande. And they're like, hey, this is our area. We're administrating it. But they're not, it's not like there's people in there. So Polk basically gets into office and he's like, hey, guys, I don't want to have a military conflict on this. This is crazy. That no man's land, you're not able to administer it. Come on. You have some troops there.
Right.
Because nobody's messing. But do you really think you're going to be able, you're not going to have a bunch of bandits. You're not going to have, come on, man. Your government can't even stand on its own two feet. You can't do any,
See, you can't insult their government, though. That's not going to win you any points in the negotiation, is it?
Well, he doesn't say that, but it's that insinuation, we can do something here. We'll pay for it. We'll, let's talk about this. So he sent John Slidell down to Mexico to negotiate the purchase of California to Mexico, settle the border disputes, and Mexico refuses to talk to him because they think having him in there
basically legitimizes anything.
Yeah, would legitimize any claim the U.S. has over Texas, which is ironic because, remember, Texas is petitioning the U.S. to join the Union, and there's a lot of people, I believe John Quincy Adams is even one of them, who didn't want Texas to join at all because they were like, hey, this is going to inflame the slave question.
Right.
So I think there was some misunderstanding on the Mexico side of what the issue really was, and so they didn't even want to hear him. So he ends up leaving. And Slidell goes back to Polk and is like, I don't know what to do. They won't talk to me. We're trying to buy the land from them. Dude, they're like, we bought land from Spain. We bought the, there's a couple, part of Florida and stuff like that. We paid for it there. Spain owned the Louisiana territory shortly before France took it back. They were administrating it effectively. So this was a little weird because right now it sounds weird to buy foreign land. But at this point, the U.S. has bought tons of foreign land and has dealt cleanly with all these other European and, branch off European nations.
It's about to be buying a bunch more. Alaska Purchases and Gadsden Purchase are both coming up.
Yep. Yeah. So it was weird they wouldn't even hear him out. And because at this point, they don't really, I don't know. I'm being speculative here, but it's kind of like, this isn't a passive endorsement. This is literally a negotiation. This is just we're not saying you have to endorse or not endorse it. At this point, Polk's just all right, he believes in Manifest Destiny. He's like, you guys won't just even, you won't even discuss with us where we think the border should be. So he calls up Zachary Taylor and goes, go, don't invade Mexico. That's the beginning. He goes, don't invade Mexico. Go to the Rio Grande. That's the border. Go establish at the border. Now, so, it's cool. Some military historians have a cool take on this.
Yeah.
Some people think Polk was trying to demonstrate to Mexico that you do not control this area. We just marched an army through this area and you did nothing. You weren't able to do anything about it. And he ends up, Taylor gets all the way down the Rio Grande and builds Fort Texas. Opposite Mexico, essentially opposite a place called Matamoros. So he ends up establishing the fort just across the river. And there's kind of this like Polk and Taylor kind of like, hey, we just marched like a massive distance into your controlled sovereign territory. We keep claiming you don't have control over this area by evidence of we just marched an entire army and built a fort and your response was nothing. You weren't able to enforce the border. And sometimes this gets painted as like aggression, right? And that's certainly an understandable position to take. I do always go back to there was a diplomat, like we had a diplomat, 5440 or fight. The northern border with the United States is not 54. Is not the 54th parallel.
You also can't leave an area completely devoid of any sort of law and order. Like, there's somebody's going to come in and fill that power vacuum. That's just the way it is.
And on top of that, like, there was never an establishment there. Like, here's the thing. Right. There's a separate discussion that should be had about Native Americans in that area. That's a much, to me, that's a much stronger argument. It's like, no, that land was already occupied by tribes.
Right.
Like, that's it. But, like, Mexico didn't have a right, like Mexico didn't have, you know, the right personnel in there to establish that area. If you want to make a comment about tribes, absolutely. I think that's a better valid exemption, but
right.
You had two nations disagreeing on a border. One nation sent the person down there and was like, hey, can we talk about this? They're like, no. And it's like, well, you and what army? Well, let me introduce you to Zach Taylor.
Yes. He's pretty good at this.
Also, not for nothing. Zach Taylor always conducted himself to like the utmost adherence to like the rules of war and sovereignty. That I also have a weird thing, like this same dude was the same guy like telling white settlers to stop settling on native land.
Yeah.
And he was cool going down to the Rio Grande. So like part of me is like, I don't know if he would have followed that order if he was like, I actually think this is Mexico. So, but we didn't live at the time, so it's hard to think of like what he was thinking. He doesn't strike me as I'm just following orders kind of general.
No.
Because he never was ever in the history of his entire time in the service. Like, very famously was not like that. So he marches his troops to the Rio Grande. This is seen as provocative, which I get. I can totally get why that's seen as provocative.
Has he spread malaria yet?
Yeah, he's probably just coughing everywhere. It's probably horrific. And it would be the war breaks out on April 25th, 1846, when Mexican cavalry crosses the Rio Grande to attack Zachary Taylor's troops. This is known as the Thornton Affair, and it results in several American casualties, and they take a bunch of prisoners. Taylor reports back, and again, this is very interesting to me, like Taylor wasn't on the offensive footing, and it's like he was on offensive footing, but he got down there. But if we think of that time period, I mean, this is really seen as empty land, like in two nations trying to discuss a border. Right. So
you think he was surprised? It's like, what are you guys doing?
I think he didn't expect the cavalry to pop up. I think he, right, not that yeah. he was like surprised, but I think he was like, oh,
you guys want to do this?
You're ready. Yeah, he was like, oh, we're fighting? Oh, what a bad decision you just made. What a horrible decision. Like, you're going to be introduced to the Marine Corps. This war, you will lose this war so bad, the U.S. Marine Corps will open its hem with what it's done to you. It's like, oh, that's scary. Yeah, it's like, that's scary, dude. That is, right. It's like, oh. If the Marines start writing about you, you know you messed up. You're like, oh, my God. So Polk goes to Congress and is like, American blood has been shed on American soil. And yeah, at that point, even the Whigs like, well, let's calm down. We're not sure if this is American soil. I don't know why I like the Whigs so much.
Are you serious?
No, that's what they said. They were like, and that's the Whig Party was very funny because it was like they had such a confusing platform. They ran the first political like machine, and even they were like, are we sure it's American soil? And then everybody's like,
has it been annexed yet?
No.
It's independent Texas at this point, then.
Right? No, this is not really like. So I'm sorry, I should rephrase this. Texas has been annexed, but
it has been okay.
The southern border has not been defined. So they're like, wait, did we just send some dude down there to negotiate this? Like, no, he came back. They don't want to talk to us. And the Whigs are like, okay. But they were like, march troops down there? That seems like provocatory. No, we stopped at the Rio. It's like, where were we trying to negotiate? The Rio. Okay, so like, we're just like, what happened when the army marched down there? Nothing? Like, they had nobody there? It's like, yeah, they had nobody stopping them. It's like, oh, that
until
feels
a month
like,
later, then they sent some cavalry guys and abducted our cook.
Yeah, right. Like, if I walked several hundred miles into a nation with an army and nobody did anything, I'd be like, I'd start questioning the ability for the nation to
question whether they own that land or not.
Yeah, just no, like again, if you're an expansionist like Polk, okay, you can see his logic. I'm not saying to agree with it. I'm kind of talking in the what's the rhetoric at the time. And so the Whigs end up having this like long discussion with Polk, like an actual like question and answer. And they're just like, so what's your justification? He's like, American blood has been shed on American soil. And they're like, okay, like, can you give us, like, a non-inflammatory like, we're looking for an actual reason to declare war. And so he kind of lays out, like, the no diplomatic solution. This is a burning issue. They've launched attacks into Texas. Like, you know, something's going to happen here. And so that's when the Whigs pretty decisively, because they controlled Congress at the time, passed the Declaration of War.
But that was the way, this is before, like, the War Powers Act, right? When the president can,
War Powers is like,
the only way to declare war was an act of Congress at this point, right?
Yes. Okay. So I think there's been five times a year since declared war. War of 1812, Mexican-American War, I believe it's the Civil War, World War I, World War II. It's like not as many times as people think it is. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong on that. It's so Mexico immediately responds, because this happens on April 25th. May 13th, Mexico also responds by declaring war.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a war. It's not like sometimes it gets painted as like Mexico is just like.
This is not a conflict. This is. Yeah.
Sometimes it's like Mexico's like, oh, I'm just minding my own business. And like, oh, we're getting attacked. It's like, no, Mexico declared war. Mexico's not a good military at the time. Like, this is like.
Right.
So now we get into the war. Now, I want to set the stage with what type of weaponry we're talking about here.
We also get like the personnel numbers and like get compositions, maybe some of that too.
Yeah. Let me bring this up.
I imagine this is still the time of cavalry, like you mentioned, so the cavalry numbers are probably pretty significant or important to know, too.
By one of my personal, one of my, I think would be very funny to do a story
full
on.
Episode on?
Yeah, this guy Alexander, I can never pronounce his name right, but I wrote him down in my notes, Donovan.
Donovan?
Yeah, Donovan. He was this like politician from Missouri who was actually like a pretty good general for one, a pretty good commander for one. But he's very famous because he stopped the execution of Joseph Smith.
Oh, I should have known that.
Yeah, I just thought that's cool. Like this random guy.
That was during the time when he was being tarred and feathered and run out of Missouri, right?
It was when he's leaving Missouri. And Mexico again, very centralized is. Run is headed by at the time still president Antonio Santillana. So 73,000 U.S. troops led by Fulbert. I don't know if you still call Fulbert, but real generals like
Major Ruff and Ready
against 40,000 Mexicans. Now I want to phrase this with what did fatalities look like? And then we get to the web because that's going to help understand what happened.
Yeah,
in war. Especially modern war, we talk about casualties, right? Injured, dead, missing, all that.
They all kind of lumped together in one, right?
Yep. Usually you can see like 10%, 20%, something like that. Like think of World War II. America fought in every single theater. About 428,000 service members died out of the millions and millions and millions who served. So those are the type of ratios we're talking. But again, a lot of people know the horrific ratios of war because they think of like the Soviet Union. Yeah. The casualty rate. Killed, wounded, and missing for the Mexicans. Out of the 40,000 troops they had, they lost 35,000.
Oh, dude, that's an annihilation.
Yes, very much so. 5,000 killed, 20,000 wounded, jeez. And 10,000 missing.
It's you don't usually get those high numbers because most of the time people surrender. By the time you get to like 20 or 30% attrition, right?
Yeah. So you're talking about just an absolutely absurd number.
How many of that
point.
Was people being killed, and how many of that was like captured?
So 50,000 killed. They think
15,
5,000 killed.
5,000. Okay,
20,000 wounded. There was a fair amount of captures, But mostly those are the wounded. And it was like, you know, it was still like a professional war that was executed. So a lot of the wounded did begin to become POWs.
It sounded like actually, I'm actually surprised it was that high of a injured but survived rate. So it sounds like modern medicine is actually starting to make an impact at this point too.
Yeah, we're starting to see that. The U.S. had 18,130 died. 11,550 were from disease, not military combat. Only 1,733 troops.
Darn you, Taylor.
Died. Yeah, right.
Patient zero.
Yeah, so it's really, if you remove the disease from the troops who weren't from around there, it's more about, of the 73,000, only about 7,000 end up becoming casualties. So the discrepancy is literally absurd. This was not, Mexico was not prepared for this war.
No.
At all.
So can we characterize like how those losses were? Was it like several major decisive battles, or was it just like a slow death of like skirmish after skirmish?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. Frontier skirmish, and then obviously the direct invasion of Mexico, but it was artillery. It was,
exploding shells. I think foreshadowed last time.
So the U.S. had an excellent logistics chain, had great industry. It was able to produce a lot of weapons. At this point, the Harper's Ferry's Armory and the Springfield Armory were both producing standardized small arms, because we're in the late 1840s by this point. The U.S. weaponry had primarily converted to percussion caps. And for rifles, and there were still some people with smooth bores, that was still common, but primarily rifles were starting to appear in large scale, or rifled barrels with percussion caps. Colt's 1841 revolver became common.
That's the one that they like smear like animal fat around the cylinders to keep them from lighting off the other ones, I think, right? Is that the gun I'm thinking of?
Well, there's one that's like a revolver as you fire. It's like a rifle that turns, but those weren't commonly issued. Those things are super dangerous too. That you should just like the cylinder would all fire. But a huge part about this is this was one of the first wars, and certainly the first war executed by the United States, where small arms had interchangeable parts, which is a huge.
Huge you'd be advantage. Able to repair everything on the field.
Being able to repair everything in sandy conditions might give you an advantage. Right. The U.S. also had a robust railroad system, steamboats, and a multi-stage logistics chain. So the idea of battle scarcity. So up until this point, and there's military historians who can talk a lot better about this. But up until this point, wars were fought. And over time, battlefield scarcity would really dictate the end of the war. Even in the medieval times, so eventually you run out of arrows, eventually you run out of everything. The U.S. was able to maintain very, very robust supply chains, so their idea of battle scarcity was on a different scale than Mexico's, which hugely contributed to the losses on Mexico's side, because the other side just didn't run out of bullets and artillery.
You have to wait till we run out of money, and that's another problem in itself.
Yes. Mexico primarily used flintlock muskets, and while they imported they had very well trained, I really want to stress, they had very well trained troops. Like, this is not,
man, you're talking about a pretty big difference. You're talking about flintlock to percussion caps,
in close range revolvers.
Like,
that's a huge difference. You're using a flintlock pistol versus somebody with a Colt, you're like, ooh, that you're not going to win there. The other issue is that Mexico was importing, had to rely on imports from Europe. In the U.S. Navy, very politely declined that. They were like, no, thank you. And they were like, oh, what about? They're like, no, thank you. And the Europeans were like, we don't care enough about this to do anything. They're just like, we're not breaking a blockade. Also, I sailed my ship over here and has sails, and something the U.S. has over there, I don't know what the hell that thing is, but it has no sails and it's moving wicked fast.
Do we have ironclads at this point?
Steamboats, not ironclads. Ironclads don't come till the Civil War, so they're not covered in iron. It's not the USS like modern.
We got like the paddle boat, like steam ships,
which is just insane. Or the worm propeller too.
Yeah,
and they're like, oh, I don't want to fight that. There's also a bunch of angry dudes on it. They call themselves Marines. I'm not super sure what they would do, but they seem really wanted to get on my boat and take my things, and I don't want to be involved in this.
Hoorah!
They're just very. They seem like they want to fight. It's very weird. And this is really the first love affair, by the way, of the Navy Marine Corps, of like fighting like the Marine, like not just like Marines being on naval ships and protecting naval ships, but the Navy being like, yo, dude, we're going to go bring you somewhere. And the Marines are like, yeah, can we beat up anybody on the way?
No.
Stay on the boat. Stay on the boat, particularly stay only on your part of the boat.
Stay in your quarters.
Why is the lock on the outside? How about you don't ask any questions? So Mexico did have a lot of arsenals at this point, particularly they had one at Puebla and then one in Mexico City. But they were...
Where did you say?
Puebla?
Is that Pueblo?
No, it's ends with an A.
Yeah? Oh, okay. I don't think I've heard of that.
I did look this up because I was like, I know that seems like that shouldn't be how it's pronounced, but that is according to Google.
I know there is a Pueblo somewhere around there.
But their outposts, these were far away, and at the time, there were some Mexicans who didn't even want to fight this war. They're kind of like, I really don't give a crap about this empty space. I don't know why you give a crap about it, but then there's a patriotism to it. But
yeah, right.
They didn't really care. Like, there was a lot of political appointments at that time. Didn't really care or want to prosecute it. So they're just like, that hurt their supply logistics. They also just couldn't, even in their own country, couldn't move stuff. They didn't have a railroad system like we had. They had steamboats.
Were they still mostly agrarian at this point, or did they have any industry really?
Yeah.
So how are you going to get farmers to care about Texas? I mean, really?
Yeah. Also, like, you got to remember, some of these places that were federalized, they liked being under a federal system. And now they're like, I also don't like a centralized authority too. Like, they're probably thinking, like, I would rise up also.
Right.
And you would actually see a Mexican Civil War breakout after the war. So that is usually a bad sign of how convicted your people were. Is that immediately after the war, they fight another war.
They just needed more practice.
And then at the end of all this, Mexico was horribly budget constrained. They didn't really have the money to even buy standardized equipment or maintain supply lines from a financial standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the war, from a small arms standpoint, the U.S. had the average American infantryman. He was carrying their model 1816 and model 1842 percussion musket, with eventually the barrels being adapted out for rifling.
Mm-hmm.
This was obviously against Mexican flintlock ignitions, which meant the Mexicans could not fight in the rain, and the U.S. could.
Oh, that could be a huge problem. Luckily, it's West Texas, so that doesn't happen as often. But if it does, it could be a problem.
Tell that to Marines.
Is it monsoon season? Yeah.
Now tell that to the Marines during their amphibious landing
in
the non-dry area of Mexico. That's a hell of an advantage.
Yeah.
We do start seeing the model 1841, the model 1842. This is kind of cool. So the model 1842, there's some derivatives of it. I don't know if they're from the same family, but it's the model 1841, also known as the Mississippi rifle, let me make sure I have that year right. Yeah, so yeah, the model 1841, known as the Mississippi rifle, is starting to become very prominent among frontline troops. And now you're talking about large bore rifles. You're now talking about something that is, you know, a massive technological shift from a smooth bore flintlock musket going to a percussion cap rifle. I mean, that is percussion
accuracy
cap,
difference, and that should be significant.
Like, and if we think about it, percussion cap never went away. They just became part of the cartridge. So even the initial technology.
So the primer is. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Mexicans, they were really relying on old style Spanish and British rifles that were incompatible. They had different calibers, so they didn't have standardized ammo.
So you couldn't even share ammo. That'd be huge. Yeah.
Right. Their powder quality was atrocious. They had so many misfires. There's tons of stories. Again, these troops are, the Mexican troops are trying to fight valiantly, but they, in a lot of cases, don't have it.
You can only do so much when you don't have the tools.
Oh, yeah. And then what became problematic for the Mexicans was the Texas Rangers. Because the Texas Rangers, even to this day, are famous for their Colt revolvers.
Oh, I thought you were going to say their roundhouses.
Also the roundhouses. And what ended up happening is that the Texas Rangers, we also see the introduction of carbines, so small maneuver rifles, is the Texas Rangers would ride in on cavalry, dismount with carbines and revolvers, getting close, and now you're somebody holding a flintlock musket against somebody using a Colt revolver. It's a massacre, and you see why we have these horrific fatalities. But that's more of a tactical answer. The strategic answer and why this, what really caused the massive discrepancy, was artillery on the battlefield. Obviously, if we look at the holistic war of logistics, it's largely the Navy just being like, you don't get nice things. It's like, oh, I want nice things. Well, you don't get any.
Yeah. I do want to ask, before we get too far or circle back to that, I want to know what kind of ships or what kind of Navy the Mexican had, Mexico had at the time.
That's my grand section. The Navy guy. I'm going to have
this. I knew you were going to have it.
So the artillery was the most professional part of the U.S. Army.
Is the most developed doctrine?
Yes. I would say the most developed doctrine in the entire military is the U.S. Navy by a pretty large.
How much of that was thanks to like Napoleon? Because I think he standardized a lot of this stuff.
We do have huge technological advancements between those two points.
Right.
It's kind of like saying, like, hey, Sun Tzu had a lot of good ideas, but is he part of modern military doctrine? Of course he is, but not some of the, like, for example, like howitzers, this made their appearance on the battlefield. Like, nothing that Napoleon did, and somebody can argue with me on this, but, like, nothing Napoleon did involved doctrine of how to use a howitzer.
Right.
So think of this as the beginning of modern artillery, not so much of artillery being kind of secondary.
I was thinking of it more as like the breakdown of the manpower and divisions and the way you do it like that. But
yeah, I mean, yeah, it is a completely different doctrine. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't find a Napoleonic war. Right. The Mexicans were fighting a Napoleonic War.
And we ironically
learned nothing from the Napoleonic War, which was like known for decimating the guys still trying to fight the last war. And then welcome to the American Revolutionary War, the American Civil War in 15 years of let's fight a Napoleonic War with more mechanized things. It's like, stop doing this. Why are you doing this?
Right. We're just going to go hide and shoot your commanders.
Yeah, right. So America had standardized the 6-pounder and the 12-pounder guns. Mm-hmm. Now remember, when we're talking about land cannons, it's pounds. When we're talking about naval cannons, it's diameter or caliber. Yes, you could say caliber feels weird when you're talking about like something that's 15 inches, 16 inches wide.
Is that the way it works? I thought it was always pounds. It was at least the naval ones, like the British side.
You could colloquially use that terms, but again, we're talking modern times, so we can't keep going back to the 16th, 1700s,
okay,
1800s, like pounds land. Caliber, Navy. So what ended up happening is the U.S. had the very developed artillery doctrine, and they, very effectively would checker in these 6-pounders and 12-pounder guns, and they used howitzers, which was something that was probably very weird to see if it's your first time fighting, is facing cannons that have a high angle of attack.
What is the difference between a howitzer and a cannon, like, exactly? Is it just
cannon
the angle?
Is a field.
It is just the angle?
Cannon's a whole type of thing. It's everything from, 155 millimeters and the blackjacks and stuff that are used today. Howitzer is more like, boom, like firing like that. Mm-hmm. Where previous cannons, sometimes like field guns.
Right, like okay, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
you
yeah.
see it coming at you, where fighting a howitzer, you're like, do-do-do. Boom! You get a massive explosion.
Okay.
Which also makes it hard to maneuver, and especially if you're not used to that, you're also thinking that it's not line of sight. Remember, if you fire
a cannon... Yeah, you can't hide behind something either.
Right. Anymore. If you fire a cannon and you drop a cannonball out at the end of the cannon at the same time it leaves, they hit the ground at the same time.
Yep.
You're getting these huge launch angles. And they're devastating. It's devastating because it's also... The U.S. Artillery Corps at the time did these things where they basically formed... with battery units, and these battery units could move very quickly. They could coordinate fire across the field, because remember, you can fire much further. They could zero in their artillery, pivot, move around, and they were really good at firing very, 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 very quick. So they were able to pretty much demolish forts. They were pretty much
they're accurate, repeatable, good spotting, just all the things that you need to have a good artillery howitzer.
And Mexico, they had some artillery, but a lot of it was very well made Spanish artillery. Spain was not bad making artillery in any measure.
Mm-hmm.
They had horrible powder. They had non-standardized calibers across their different cannons. They had a really, really complicated. They had a lot of ammunition, but they had a complicated ammunition supply chain that the U.S. horribly exploited. Mexico did not really adopt an NCO corps, so they had very, very well-trained artillery officers, but just not enough of them. And they really didn't have a lot of horses to tow their stuff around.
Did they have any, like, they didn't really have any production capabilities either. So everything they had is just left over from what Spain made, too. So there's no repair parts coming in. There's nothing to maintain it. You've lost all the skilled labor that knows how to even, like, keep up the stuff, too, right? Yeah.
And again, why I thought it was important to bring up, you know, how distinct howitzers are, is this is one of the first times in world history we see counter-battery fire. So the Mexicans would fire direct artillery, and they get hit with howitzers.
Oh, geez.
And just raining and raining down howitzers. There's an old British joke during World War II, which is how does a German know who they shot at? If they fire at somebody and are hit with what feels like accurate machine gun fire, oh, they shot at a Brit. If they fired at somebody and a white flag went up, well, they fired at the Frenchmen. If they fired at Americans and nothing happened for a few minutes and they got hit with artillery, they fired at an American. And so, yeah, the U.S. just, I mean, that's going to be, again, counter-battery fire is going to feel bizarre. You're like, oh, I'm a cannon. I'm firing from really far away. The other cannon's on the other side of the battlefield, so he can't reach me either, not realizing that you've had this massive technological advantage and you now have incredibly well-trained soldiers raining hell down on you.
It's like the you know what the F4 Wild Weasel used to do in combat?
Oh, yeah, he used to, it would pretend to be.
Basically just goes and smoke out SAM installation sites and then wait for them to shoot at it and then fire a missile and destroy it.
Yeah, kind of what they're doing.
Same thing, right? Yeah.
Now, getting to cavalry. Cavalry was very interesting. So Mexico's cavalry on paper was numerous. They had incredibly, they were actually some of the best horsemen
in the entire
world.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned they didn't have a whole lot of horses when I thought they, the cavalry.
There's a huge difference between a draft horse and a cavalry. So they've used cavalry horses. It's like, you can have a lot of jeeps, but no amount of jeeps replaces a tank, right? Like, they had these very elite soldiers, lancers, who were armed with the traditional lance. And they were, even American soldiers were like, they were incredibly intimidating. I mean, seeing a wall of incredibly good horsemen with lances is scary. Even today, I wouldn't want to roll
shakes,
up somewhere.
Man. It's not. Yeah, it's terrifying.
Until you run into revolvers and carbines.
They usually causes horses to go run away.
Yeah, they couldn't. Even when the horses stood tall, they just wiped them out. Like, you're talking, not as trained horsemen. I mean, think of the hours it comes to become an elite horseman. Think of all that time. And then, a Kentucky boy with a good aim and a carbine.
Right.
Yeah, it is quite interesting because the Mexicans kind of didn't know how, that was supposed to be, and this caused a huge morale issue, was these were the elite units. They were supposed to go in there like, oh, the Americans won't be able to stand up to them. And they'd get ripped apart by artillery and gunned down by rifle fire. And then once they got close enough to use their lances, in a lot of cases, they were running into Americans transitioning to six-shooters.
Right. So just getting shot up close range,
these are not pocket revolvers. These are, carrying very large caliber rounds. These are probably something
like 44 long rifle usually,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 45 long, yeah. and, 45 long, which you can stick a 410 as in the freaking shotgun shell inside of it. And this is not being, this is horrific. And unfortunately, Mexican leadership kind of didn't want to acknowledge that. They were like, oh, that was a fluke. And I was like, how did you think that? What made you think that was a fluke? and then it got worse because when they attacked in large waves, the Lancers didn't really know what to do once they got close in. Like, they couldn't dismount.
Right.
So they kind of just like oh, we got here? And then we get mowed down. Also, rapid firing 6-pound artillery shells is going to tear through them nothing. Again, you just demoralized all your troops.
Plus, the whole point of a cavalry is to run as like a massed wave too. So like you're just a massive like target for accurate artillery fire.
Right. The Americans did have did cavalry. The Texas Rangers were a form of cavalry, but America uses cavalry much much different. So they used it as scouts, raiding units was another thing they did, and they actually introduced. Not a modern, it's certainly not, I don't want to call it a modern one because it's existed forever in war, but they were big on using the cavalry as skirmishers. And that's a term that feels colloquial sometimes, but it is a thing. So what skirmishers' job was to do was either harass small groups of scouts, or position yourself in the rear where you're basically fighting, rear guard troops, or just cause chaos on the battlefield by just starting a fight over in some random corner.
Or lighting a supply train on fire somewhere.
And that's the other thing they did. Mexico has already had limited logistics. The Navy was already starving them out. And these cavalry would go deep on enemy lines and deny the enemy of Knight's things consistently. But before we move on, before we close out the section of what military prowess they had, or military technology, the materiel they had, naval capabilities. I like this one. This one's fun.
Okay. Okay.
So long gone are the days of the U.S. debating in the 18-teens and the 1820s whether or not the U.S. should have a military presence.
The War of 1812 convincing people of the prudence of it?
Yes, and Mr. Fulton and his steam engine became very popular. So the U.S. Navy at this point had a fully modern fleet, like a fleet on par with probably any European nation, probably any nation around the world, barring the Brits.
Wow, really?
So these are steam-powered, blue water-capable ships. Like, these are meant to travel the world.
Huh.
And this is also kind of when we start to see proto, I don't want to say proto battleships, but proto cruisers. Modern cruisers.
Did we have a presence in the Pacific at this point too, or is this all mostly?
No, so this is all the Caribbean. We wouldn't really. Yeah. This war would end up with us establishing a Pacific base, but that'd be because California would join the Union.
Yeah, yeah.
So the U.S. deploys this, you know, very capable fleet of blue water fleet. It goes in there. At this point, Mexico's Navy is outdated. It has no ability to contest the U.S. or protect its coastal city, and the U.S. Navy at this time is basically practicing a doctrine of any Mexican ship is a threat. And there's a very interesting part of the Navy strategy, Navy theory coming in here. It extends from a higher position, which is the idea that the quickest way to end the war is to make the enemy unable to fight a war. And in a sense, that's the most ethical war to fight is the war. The most ethical war to fight is no war. I don't know if I believe that.
You end the war as quickly as you possibly can to save as many lives as you can.
Yeah. And so the U.S. gets down there and basically eviscerates the Mexican Navy. At this point, like, there isn't a good idea on, like, how to fight. Like, this idea of fighting a mechanized Navy versus a non-mechanized Navy. Like, there's not a doctrine for that.
Yeah. Everything was, like, line, ship of the line, right? So you're lining up and, like, maneuvering and trying to
And I don't know, Kyle, you can yell at me how you pronounce it. I pronounce it littoral. Some people pronounce it literal.
So no, I think you're right, littoral.
Like the class of the ship is called a littoral class ship. Yes. Oh no, it's pronounced literal. It's like it is, but it isn't.
So literally no.
Like this, a lot of this is littoral based combat, and again, you talk about modernized military, modernized naval guns. And the Mexican Navy, you know, fought very bravely. The problem was the other guy could just hit you. It was like it was a huge discrepancy in range. And the guy that is hitting you with better guns, better powder, better ammunition, with a more well-trained troop on a much faster platform. And so they very quickly just completely dispatched the ragtag Mexican Navy and just completely blockade Mexico. And again, the Europeans are just not interested in this.
Right.
They're just like, no, thank you.
Yeah. I wish you would have spent more time on that economy.
Yeah, that would
certainly have been a little bit stronger. You might have had some people risking the blockade, right?
I do feel for Mexico in here because it's, in a sense, they very much wanted, they very much did not want to fight this war. But they viewed it as, the people who wanted to fight the war viewed it as a necessary enforcement of their sovereignty.
We must stand up for ourselves.
Right. And I think at the end of the, but I always go back to them turning away the diplomat. And I'm always like Polk negotiated a campaign prompt, his campaign slogan. He negotiated. He did not fight. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know if Polk would have fought.
And that, my friends, is where we'll leave you, standing on the banks of the Rio Grande, staring at two armies, three bad decisions, and absolutely no agreement on whose dirt anyone is standing on. Next week is part two, where the artillery starts booming, generals start improvising, and the chaos somehow gets worse. If you thought this was wild, trust me, we haven't even hit the body count yet, the hero worship, or even the political meltdown waiting back in Washington. So thanks for hanging out with us on the Buck Starts Here, Buck Wild Edition. I'm Kyle, that's Eric. We'll catch you next time for the part of the war where stuff actually explodes. Stay curious, stay chaotic, and don't let Pope negotiate on your behalf.
Produced by China Shop Productions.